This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Later on, how the Weinstein verdict and sentencing is a huge win for Me Too. But first, gearing up for the global days of action on military spending or arming ourselves to disarm the military budget.
We'll not fight your war, said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and 'twas well that he stood. I will not fight your war, said the child, and he stood. Mm-hmm. Oh, but don't you love your country, said the man.
The bell. Drums of war. Lindsay Kashgarian is the program director of the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she works on analysis of the federal budget process and politics, military spending, and specifically how federal budget choices for different spending priorities and taxation actually interact. A particular area of focus is how a decades-long policy of outsized military budgets beating the drums of war has eroded investment in human potential through greater support of education and healthcare, infrastructure, and more. And we're very, very pleased to have Lindsay with us. And I want to go straight into helping us understand the issue of the military budget versus, and it is versus, human needs. On February 29th, 2020, Trump hailed the end to the Afghan conflict as the U.S. and Taliban signed a deal to end the 18-year war. Well, what's the skinny? Talk to us and take us from rhetoric to reality so that we can engage this discussion of the decrease in the military spending budget.
Thanks for having me. And one important date that you noted, which Trump announced prematurely the end of the war in Afghanistan, and this is a war, of course, that has gone on for nearly 20 years, and now the youngest people who are going off to fight in this war weren't even born when the original impetus for the war, 9/11, happened. So this has been America's longest war. It's been an extremely costly war. This is a encouraging first step, but it is only the first step on a very long path. And there's a lot of negotiation and diplomacy left to be done if this original this first step is going to actually lead to bringing our troops home. That's what ending the war in Afghanistan should mean. It should mean, you know, not that we have a few thousand troops left, but that we've actually brought our troops home. And another date that I just want to bring up that's closely related and was also close together in days is February 10th, which is the day that the Trump administration released their budget proposal for fiscal year 2021, which begins in October. In that budget, there was no sign of an intention to end our wars. The war budget, something known as overseas contingency operations, as it is a specific separate part of the budget from the rest of the Pentagon budget. And that budget was the same this year as it's been the last several years. So no sign that they're expecting to be spending less money on this war.
What are we actually spending for the military budget, and how can we spend less, still stay safe? And where are some of the examples of bloat?
We're spending about $740 billion, and it's hard to put that in some context. That's more than half of the discretionary budget, which is the budget that Congress allocates each year and goes through this long, prolonged budget process. To come up with. And it includes everything except what are called the big entitlement programs, which are actually programs that we all pay into and therefore not entitlements, but Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid. Those are separate. But pretty much everything else in a federal budget comes under this heading of the discretionary budget, and more than half of that goes to the Pentagon. And what that means is that there's less than half left for everything else, for federal housing programs and federal education programs from preschool up through college, community economic development programs and job training programs and infrastructure and medical research, which is, of course, something that is on many of our minds right now. So all of those things have to fit into less than half of the federal budget. That $740 billion, it was $716 last year, is also more than we were spending at the peak of the Vietnam War. So we're at a historically very high level of Pentagon spending, which you would never know from listening to Pentagon leaders who continually ask for more.
The issue of contracting, talk about that as well as part of that incredible amount of bloat. I guess it's tens of billions of dollars of waste.
We have a myth in this country that more military spending will make us safer and that more military spending will support the troops. But frequently, neither of those things are true. More than half of our Pentagon budget is going to corporate for-profit contractors for lucrative contracts. The biggest contractor, Lockheed Martin, takes in more money than many federal agencies. The Lockheed Martin budget is about five times the budget of the Environmental Protection Agency every year. You know, there's a huge amount of money that's going to these contractors. It's not even just the weapons, it's also service contractors. We all heard about the outsourcing of, you know, sort of security workers in Iraq and Afghanistan, but it's everything from cafeteria work to IT support. It's a hundreds of billions of dollar industry, and those costs have gone up, in particular the service costs. It now costs four times as much to support each individual troop as it did in 1980. And a big part of the reason for that is the increasing outsourcing of functions from government workers to more expensive contractors.
I believe roughly, I've heard the number $600 billion per year is the current Pentagon budget. And Trump was talking about throwing an additional $1 trillion at the bloated department over the next 10 years. Meanwhile, there's the verba to close essential public services or slash them to ribbons. Juxtapose those two and help us understand what we lose.
Right. So the Trump budget proposal itself is kind of a nightmare proposal. It calls for increasing Pentagon spending over the next 10 years. And it also calls for drastic cuts to essentially everything except the Pentagon and immigration enforcement, so deportations and his border wall. Those are the only areas where he wants to spend more and a bit more on veterans benefits as well. So all of his spending revolves around the military and the militarization of our borders. Meanwhile, his budget proposal, he calls for cuts to everything else. So it would eliminate the low-income heating assistance program that helps people with low incomes stay warm in the winter. Drastically cut the budget for the EPA that makes sure that we have safe drinking water, which is still an issue for thousands of communities around the country. Drastically cut the State Department budget, which is an interesting move for someone who's talking about negotiating all of these peace deals around the world with Afghanistan, and we've heard about North Korea, and those are things that can't happen unless there is a strong and well-qualified, powerful State Department with enough resources to negotiate those peace deals. There are many different areas. You know, he would cut the National Science Foundation by 6%, which is, you know, the big federal fund for scientific research. He would cut after-school programs. He would cut school nutrition programs. Many, many things that are integral parts of our communities that President Trump has proposed year after year to cut. Congress has not chosen to make those cuts so far, and it very much is up to Congress. And they have not chosen so far to cut these programs at anything like the level that the president has proposed. And in some cases, they're even moderately increasing spending. But what has happened is that because the programs are under constant attack, is that it has really prevented people on the left, with some major exceptions, from trying to move things forward. It's a constant game of defense instead of trying to move into the next thing. It's toward universal health care or toward better public education for everyone or toward, you know, more affordable or free college for all. All of those priorities are things that get consistently pushed back because people on the left are playing defense against threatened cuts that come back year after year.
Would you think it's fair to say that the lack of preparedness for the COVID-19 epidemic reveals the potentially grave consequences of slashing social safety net spending while deluging the military-industrial complex with our tax dollars?
I do. I think it's extremely fair. We know that there have been cuts to the CDC, actual cuts to specific CDC programs that are relevant for the COVID-19 outbreak. We know that the cuts and the gutting of the State Department is relevant because our relationships with other countries are so, our allies are so bad right now that it's hampering the ability to coordinate messaging around the outbreak. It's hampering the ability probably to coordinate the actual response on the ground. And now, we, of course, there's this European travel ban that's just been announced. There's a breaking down of international relations to the United States that's also extremely relevant and a perfect example of why we need those alliances and why we need to keep them strong.
Certainly, progressive people have for decades talked about the bloated military budget juxtaposed with the slashing of social service and public service institutions. How do we really begin at this juncture, particularly in such an aggressive, militarized administration, change that national spending priority with the public so that we can repurpose the military budget for human needs?
Of course, I'm going to say that education is a key part of it, which is what we do at National Priorities Project. For instance, when you ask people how much of the budget people may have heard when people are asked in the general public how much they think we spend on foreign aid, you know, they'll say something like a quarter of the federal budget, or, you know, they'll guess these very high numbers. The truth is that we spend less than 1% of the budget on federal aid. So part of it is making sure that people understand where their money is actually going. So for instance, the fact that only 20% of the Department of Defense budget actually goes to pay the troops, and the rest of it is contracts and expensive weapons systems and deploying those troops over and over and over again without end all around the world to the different sites of our conflict. Step one is for people to understand where their money is going now. Step two is really to understand that, of course, there's all this rightful focus right now on the presidential race, but to understand the importance of those down ballot races and to understand the importance of who's representing you in Congress and communicating with that person who's representing you in Congress, because it is in the Constitution that Congress has the power of the purse. They are the ones who make the decisions about how the money is spent. The president cannot make those decisions on his or her own. Understanding, you know, who represents you, what their positions are. If you haven't reached out, you call their office or even go and visit and ask what their positions are on key issues that you care about. Then let them know what you want their priorities to be. Because that kind of citizen outreach is very effective. And we know from research that's been done that it doesn't take that many constituents reaching out to a member of Congress to get their attention. Now, that can't be one of those mass emails where you click a button and send an email. But if you call or if you show up in person, that makes a real impression. And people don't appreciate enough how powerful that is. And then I would say step three is to join so many of the wonderful organizations and movements that are working on issues that connect to the federal budget. And almost every issue does. Climate change or Medicare for All or, you know, free college or fixing our economy so that people, you know, don't, there's not just a allegedly low unemployment rate, but that people actually have jobs that support them and their families. All of those things are federal budget issues.
And be aware that April 10th to May 9th is being designated as the Global Days of Action on Military Spending. And we want to disarm the Pentagon budget to repurpose it for human needs. And you can certainly find out more about that by just going to the website of the Institute for Policy Studies. And we'd like to thank Lindsay Kazgarian to continue to talk about how we change the national spending priorities and the culture of militarism in this country. Lindsay, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mimi.
And now a tribute to one of our beloved, beloved musician whose music you must continue to listen to and raise up. We lost the great pianist, jazz musician, McCoy Tyner. Let's listen to Atlantis. Magnificent pianist McCoy Tyner, presente. Sexual predator Harvey Weinstein was sentenced to serve 23 years in prison. The question is whether verdict brings a sigh of relief and a victory for survivors of sexual violence everywhere. And to talk with us about what the significance of the Weinstein indictment, the verdict, and sentencing is, Allegra Fischel, founder and executive director of the Gender Equality Law Center, a champion of women's rights and our champion. It's lovely to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
A sigh of relief, certainly. A victory for survivors of sexual violence everywhere. Is that the case with the sentencing and the entire way that this trial proceeded?
I think it's a combination, really. I don't think one could say it's just a victory, but it is certainly a significant decision. Mr. Weinstein is the first high-profile man to be convicted in this period of the so-called Me Too movement. It is hugely significant that survivors or victims of rape and sexual assault actually could bring a case against such a high-powered individual. I think historically, even though there were many women that came forward, there would be huge issues of credibility and doubt and social pressure not to come forward. So it is really a huge victory to see that prosecutors took the case seriously and he received almost the maximum sentence. I think a lot of watchers were very surprised that he received a 23-year sentence. I think that most people thought he would receive significantly below that amount of time. So in many ways, this is a huge victory, particularly in the criminal law and crimes victim arena.
Do you think that it illuminates a new way for the public of looking at sexual violence? Have we learned from this, whereas habitually there's been in the cases of sexual assault, rape, sexual violence, a blame of the victim habitually?
Yes. In fact, historically, there was always blame on women coming forward. And probably the biggest issue was questioning their credibility. And when you intersect that with the kind of power that Harvey Weinstein had, both in terms of his reputation and both in terms of also how much money he earned, historically, women simply, the scales were really balanced against them. Also, in this case, the women continued, the two actual individuals that prosecuted the case through the district attorney's office as opposed to the supporting witnesses, did continue in some way to have an ongoing consensual relationship with Mr. Weinstein after the assaults. And I think at another period in time, the district attorney would never have brought a case in which the behavior of these women seemed to suggest that they, in fact, had not been assaulted. So there is a huge shift in looking at the perpetrator and the crime rather than questioning and assessing and sometimes almost crucifying women over whether or not they really were telling the truth.
A major part of the defense was exactly what you just mentioned, and so far as, well, there was a continued relationship. Of course, this man continues to say, consensual, consensual, consensual. So what are we to understand better about the whole idea of the power relationships and whether or not things are mitigated or vitiated by virtue of the fact that there may have been a continuing engagement with each other for whatever purposes?
The power dynamic always shades what consent means. In this particular case, I don't believe these women continued to have any type of relationship with Mr. Weinstein because they really enjoyed his company or wanted to have some kind of interaction with him, or as the defense said, were interested in having this extramarital affair because I believe Mr. Weinstein was married during most of this period of time. Consent always has to be looked at within the context of a power differential. So, for instance, my work, which is focused on workplace and education-based violence, so it's more in the civil arena, you always have to look. When a powerful man in the workplace is pressuring a subordinate to have a sexual relationship, she may not be tied down or held up in a closet, but the pressure to keep her job may make her have a relationship. Is that consensual? I would say no. So the power dynamic is just enormous. The same thing with a professor and a student who may fear that their grades or their future career will be impacted.
So we have to understand that as a form of brutalization as well, that lording over somebody, controlling their career potentially, or other aspects of their life, somebody who is a nanny, somebody who is a maid, a woman farm worker in the fields. They may not be physically brutalized, but they are otherwise, and we have to understand this power relationship as a form of brutalization. And I still don't think we're there as a society.
I would totally agree. I think the paradigm and the image that most people, even progressive people, hold is that when a woman is sexually assaulted or raped or even sexually harassed, she is a victim because she was physically restrained, she did not know her perpetrator, she did everything she possibly could to physically defend herself. There was absolutely nothing that she did to continue to put herself in what some people would say is harm's way. But if you have a power differential, for instance, if you're working on a job or you're working in the fields and you have no option but to continue to put yourself in harm's way because you may need to support your family, that's where society really still disbelieves many women. Now, I do think the Me Too movement is changing that as we begin to understand that sexual assault and sexual harassment are not always because someone is just attacked. It's often in a situation where someone has to encounter their perpetrator day in and day out.
So it looks like we can say that this indictment, conviction, and sentencing really helps kickstart further a national movement that will empower survivors to break their silence and which can lead to accountability for countless abusers.
Yes, I agree. I don't think one can underestimate this is an enormous victory for survivors of sexual violence, who are mostly women, but sometimes are men. And let's not forget that folks in the LGBTQ community are often assaulted and violated as well. So it definitely sends a strong message that prosecutors are willing to take these types of cases seriously, even when the victims did not act as sort of a prototype victim, the way that society has essentially look to framing their behavior. And there were no witnesses. And I do think that this is a watershed moment. I don't think it's enough, but I think it sends a strong message that even someone like Harvey Weinstein is going to be made accountable for his behavior.
And you say it's not enough. Where do we go from here? How do we expand? How do we educate the public even further to understand the nature of the brutalization that occurred to these women and why these power relationships and power brokers who brutalize people not consensually? Consent doesn't represent an inequity of power that forces people to capitulate to otherwise save their career or what have you. Where do we go from here?
That's really well said, Mimi. Well, I think there's got to be a lot of different ways that we go from here. One would be, and there's been a lot of discussion on this in the news, is about ensuring that there are not mandatory non-disclosure agreements. I'm talking particularly in the civil setting, because when individuals come forward and make complaints and then are silenced, then information doesn't get out. Other people don't know that there is a recurring problem. They don't feel that they can come and complain because they think that they're alone. So I think that non-disclosure agreements are a problem. They create silence. They cloak violence. They cloak harassment. I think another problem is that we need to educate people about the things you were talking about, that women do not always behave the way that we think they may, that power differentials are significant, and we need to work and educate victims not to be ashamed and humiliated to come forward, but to feel empowered and supported by not only the people around them, but by society.
And we've been gratefully speaking with Allegra Fischel, founder and executive director of the Gender Equality Law Center, about the 23-year sentence of sexual predator Harvey Weinstein. Allegra, thank you so much for imparting your knowledge to us.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Mimi.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.